Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
One thing for sure, Sylvia, that is becoming more apparent to more and more working class people and ordinary citizens, regardless of their social status, is that there is a general collapse of a public authority through government that defends public interest and public right. And what we have increasingly is government serving monopoly interest.
That's the voice of journalist Charles Borland. On this week's show, we speak to Charles about the many struggles of 2013 and the changing society and retreat of the state, and what we must do in the new year to turn things around. Stay tuned.
Charles Borland is a well-known independent radio activist here in Vancouver. He is the co-host of Discussions, a weekly radio show on Co-op Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sylvia, and a happy new year to you and all of your listeners. May 2014 see a serious advance in the resistance against the Harper government and others like him.
Thank you, Charles. New Year's not only require a revision of where we've been and sort of imagining where we're going. You know, I was thinking about the notions of a very well-known writer in Latin America, José Vasconcelos. He wrote a thesis on the raza cósmica, and he was thinking about how do we create a world that is found on the vision of kind of spiritually grounded, but also acknowledging, you know, the material limitations of our environment. And I think this visioning of who we are and where we are is an important stage for us to engage as workers. What is our vision for the future? How do we unite to the concerns of everyone, you know, that shares the world?
Right. Well, Sylvia, of course, when you mention Latin America and we think of New Year's Day, New Year's Eve Day, we obviously turn our attention to the fact that 55 years ago on January 1st, the young revolutionaries in Cuba under the leadership of Fidel Castro and his brother Raul and others, Che Guevara and all of those heroes of that epoch, that moment, took power in Cuba and brought about changes in the little republic, island republic of the Caribbean, that have had such historic impact on all of Latin America, indeed Canada, the United States of America, which still continues in its illegal blockade of Cuba, something that is voted against every year in the United Nations by the overwhelming number of states, with the United States only having Israel basically as its ally. And so that's one thing for sure. When we review, as you said, we think of what are the challenges that the workers in Canada and around the world face in this year 2014. One thing for sure, Sylvia, that is becoming more apparent to more and more working class people and ordinary citizens, regardless of their social status, is that there is a general collapse of a public authority through government that defends public interest and public right. And what we have increasingly is government serving monopoly interest, and directly so, directly very specific. And we'll come to discuss some of these very direct private interests that get promoted a little later in the conversation. But entering the new year is a good time to reflect on the challenges that we as workers face, whether in the public sector, private sector, whether we provide material, produce material goods, transport them, or produce services that are required by the society. We have a duty to ourselves and the country to take up the mantle of nation building. It is a responsibility. And it's very important when we think of rights, we also think of duties and responsibilities. As it is, the federal government, the government in Quebec, all the provinces and territories are depriving the people of any public authority that can defend them from the greed of these global corporations and monopolies. Powerful private interests dictate affairs of state. They've overwhelmed the public authority. And so what we have is that these dominant private interests, whether it's that railroad company, for example, that blew up Lac-Mégantic back in the summer and killed so many people, you know, or the oil trusts that insist on pushing oil either by pipeline or by rail to the detriment of the public safety, or any number of examples we could give closing down enterprises like the U.S. Steel Corporation or Heinz closing down the Leamington plant and so on. All of these are examples whereby the private interests through government are imposing their will, and the people have no defender of the public interest. They eliminate regulations, they eliminate rules that restrict the actions of predatory companies, they allow the usurpation of political power by private interests across the board. So the well-being and security of people and the social environment and the natural environment are at great risk because of the people's disempowerment. And so this is a major, major question that needs to be taken up, namely the empowerment. How does the working class become empowered? And when you look at Canadian society, modern society generally across the board, which social force is there that is large enough that can have the cohesion, the social cohesion and determination and aim, as well as the social consciousness, to reverse this wrecking that is going on at the behest of these corporations pursuing their private anarchistic kind of interests, one against the other and against the society as a whole? So it is really, in our view, the working class which is responsible for moving the country forward to new arrangements that will harmonize individual interests with the collective interest, because all workers work in some kind of collective. There is a collective interest. And then there's the individual interest, collective interest, having to be harmonized with the interests of a society in general, the general interest. And so this harmonization is really a goal for rearranging power relations in a modern society. And it is a task that I think really faces us in 2014, namely to help prepare conditions for that realization. And that requires how to organize ourselves, how to defend wages and benefits, and that are commensurate with the work that the workers do. These are all under attack. We saw that all throughout last year and the year before, the assault on the Air Canada workers, the assault on the postal workers, the lowering of wages and attack on their pensions, and so on. So when we look how the working class is to become effective in carrying out this social responsibility to fight for modern and safe working conditions that allow workers to produce goods and services at highest quality, then we really have to see how this works out in concrete reality. For example, rail workers' working conditions are the safety conditions for the communities and the rail line, safe transportation of goods. The same when the airline workers, their work conditions are the passengers, or the education conditions. The teachers don't have good working conditions, good salaries, good resources, and so on and so forth. The education results for the learning conditions of the students suffer, same in healthcare, and so on and so forth. So there really is a direct connection between empowerment of workers, empowerment of those sections of society that produce goods and services, and the realization of their needs both at the workplace and in the society as a whole, to providing society with the best possible results or the best possible consequence. So I think this is really the tough task that faces us ahead, Sylvia, how the working class takes stock of the situation, how it discusses the issues in front of it. There's a great deal, as you know, pressure on workers not to discuss things, not to reflect on matters, but just to be a productive force, just to keep their noses clean, you know, be consumers once they go home from the workplace, not trouble themselves with really big questions. The point is that debate has to be real and substantial in the future. And I can just give a couple of examples how private business decisions directly harm the economy. You can have, for example, the United States Steel Corporation ended up buying out Stelco in Hamilton when I was a youth. Sylvia, Stelco employed 15,000 workers, a major, major steel producer. Well, now there's less than 600 people on the job, and U.S. Steel, a foreign company with a vested interest in destroying Canadian steel production, has decided there will be no future steel production at their mill. So that's a very major decision. That will affect workers in Hamilton. It will affect Canadian workers. Canadians import steel by the tons. All this construction you see in Vancouver, it all depends on steel. It's imported from China, it's imported from the U.S., it's imported from Russia. Where's the Canadian steel? Then you have the decision by Heinz Company. There's a group of owners, I don't detail them all, but they're all knowable. They're all real human beings in the United States of America. Excuse me. They bought Heinz, and the first thing they did, they reviewed their assets. They said, oh, we don't need the plant in Leamington, Ontario. Well, excuse me, that plant has been employing 800 workers, processing locally grown tomatoes, very important food source. Everybody uses Heinz ketchup, and they decide to close that plant down. So that's 800 jobs in that community gone. That's 500 farmers who can't produce tomatoes for them. Who the hell decides that? These billionaires in the U.S., these kind of very wealthy, powerful people are making decisions in the private domain, and government is simply falling on its knees. I'll give you a very good example right here in B.C., Sylvia. Canfor, big, huge wood monopoly, local Canadian capitalist guy, Jim Patterson's part of that gang, and they have decided to close down two very viable, profitable mills right here in British Columbia, one in Quesnel and the other one in Williams Lake. And why? Because they are going to set up a condominium with a Chinese capitalist in China, and they're going to import raw logs from British Columbia, and they're going to process them in China. Oh my God. So who decided that? And how come the workers in Williams Lake and the community of Williams Lake and the workers in Quesnel, the community of Quesnel, can't say no? How come the provincial government can't intervene and say, on behalf of public interest, you see, say, oh, sorry, guys, you know, really, that's going too far. So these are examples of private business decisions harming the economy and the public interest being totally deprived. The public authority not defending public interest and public right, but defending private monopoly interest. So this question of empowerment and taking up decision-making, who decides, is crucial for 2014. It's crucial for the future generally ahead, for the whole young generation, for our generation, for the pensioners, and so on and so forth.
I think one of the most important things that we realize is that we not only are empowered by the kinds of systems that we live under, and those systems we also participate in co-creating, by the way. So we have to be aware of our responsibility and how we maintain and reproduce those systems. You know, this idea of neoliberalism becoming just a natural transition of capital is not natural at all. It has been imposed by force, by violence. And so I think that here is a very important lesson to learn, because if we're going to look at the way we are affected locally, we have to understand how it functions politically on a global level. You know, our experience here in Canada, if the government in Canada is able to silence scientists, if the government in Canada is able to privatize entities that have been part of our consciousness in Canada, the national healthcare system, the BC Rail, the post office, you know, all of these things are examples, are also markers that set a new low of devaluation of the working class worldwide. Our media, our corporate media, has been very silent about these very important issues to the workers here. They've been very vocal about stories like Mandela, you know, and what it meant, you know, to have this enormous man, you know, that just has changed the course of history. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because for me, Mandela is a man that was also born out of a movement, and it wasn't just him. It was the millions of people that died alongside with him, imagining a world without apartheid. So can we talk a little bit about that story?
Well, I think we should, definitely, Sylvia. There's no question that Mandela symbolizes not only the struggle of the African National Congress and the South African people to overthrow apartheid and to engage in nation building without that terrible racist regime enslaving the people there, but he represents part and parcel of that whole wave of anti-colonial national liberation struggle that swept Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean after World War II. So the South African liberation movement took up arms, as we know from knowing the life of Nelson Mandela, only after every possibility for peaceful change had proven fruitless. And Mandela, who we know died on December the 5th in his home in Johannesburg, had been active in the African National Congress itself was born in 1912 under British colonial, in the British colonial times, and become a leader of it since the 1940s. And he was the guy who organized the Spear of the Nation. It's the armed wing of the ANC, and he organized that after the Sharpsville Massacre in March of 1960, when the people were massacred by unarmed, defenseless people shot by the South African racist police force. And then, of course, he when he took up armed struggle, he was arrested and put in prison in 1962, and he spent 27 years there. While he was in prison and maintained his patriotic stance against the regime while he was in jail, the masses led a huge upsurge of struggle in the country. They made it impossible to rule the townships in South Africa. They did take up arms. They did fight very tenaciously, and it was a very important struggle. And then they launched these provocative wars against the what they call the frontline states. Angola, which had just won its independence through national armed struggle against Portugal, and then the people of Zimbabwe they attacked, and also the people of Mozambique. And in Angola, the situation was quite grave, actually. A front that was the South Africa propped up was attacking the government there, and that government in Angola gave a call for international support, and the only ones who answered that call, Sylvia, were the Cubans. And this is not generally recognized, mm-hmm. that Cuba sent a very large army to assist Angola at Angola's call. They did it without any urging or egging on by any state. The Soviet Union was quite shocked, actually, to find out that the Cubans had taken this initiative in their own hands. They fought a major battle at the Angolan town of Quito, Cornaval. That battle, they very seriously damaged the South African army, racist army, and they destroyed the myth of the military invincibility of that racist South African armed force. And that greatly helped clear the ground for Mandela and the ongoing revolutionary movement within South Africa. So one has to see the kind of whole picture there. And then when one sees the state of affairs in Africa, we know that Madiba is gone. Madiba is his famous nickname, the leader of the struggle, Nelson Mandela. When he died, we know that the struggle does go on because all of Africa, Sylvia, is ravaged today in a manner that speaks about the absolute callousness and brutality of these international corporations who operate under cover of darkness here and carry on these dreadful wars. In the Congo, they've killed over 3 million people in the last decade. You see the new state of southern Sudan being torn to pieces. We see the disunity of the African people being played up by all of these corporate interests that are hiding behind and selling arms and inciting. And in northern Africa, we see the terrible reactionary setback of the Egyptian people by the fascist regime of the army in Egypt that is declared the Muslim Brotherhood illegal, even though they won the presidency. They criminalized dissent, they criminalized the journalists, criminalized the youth that participated in that revolutionary upsurge in Egypt. So when we think of Nelson Mandela, we must think of the whole continent. We must think of Patrice Lumumba. We must think of Egypt. We must think of the peoples everywhere in Africa who still strive and in their hearts yearn to unify the African people against that terrible drawing of boundaries that was done by the European racist imperial powers in Germany, in Berlin, in 1885, way back then. That's when they drew the boundaries for the 54 countries of Africa. And, you know, Africa has got the second, of all the continents, has the second highest population, mm-hmm. the second territorial size following Asia. And it is a continent of the future. It is a continent that has yet to realize the great vision of Nelson Mandela and all of his comrades in that struggle. And that struggle does definitely continue.
I think, Charles, I'm so glad that you bring us there, because the struggle really is over who controls the meaning, the symbolism of our struggle, how it becomes co-opted. When you see President Obama showing up and having this great speech, and it's lovely. I mean, I love to hear those words. I like to see them put in practice. But the point is that Mandela was a great man, to be sure, a man who inspired millions, but he isn't the movement himself. There's a movement of people that is afoot today, that is rising up, that is still defending and fighting for dignity and justice.
But, you know, in 2013, there was a big miners' resistance against the capitalists in the mines that produce, platinum.
Exactly.
And they rose up, and, you know, they were massacred there. And it reminded me so much as a youth when I remember the Sharpsville Massacre in 1960, and I saw these shooting of these African miners, South African miners, by the police force of South Africa. I said, oh, my God. You know, so still huge struggle to carry on to make sure that the workers and the people of Africa have their rights defended without being criminalized by the states there.
I think that we need to be skeptical about this idea of the heroic notion, because when you make it about a hero, you dismiss the millions of people who are, you know, fighting and struggling for justice. And,
yes,
and
by the way, Sylvia, see the film Mandela still. I hear what you're saying about one person not being all. And of course he doesn't. And he never said that of himself either. But the film Mandela is worth seeing. It has big gaps, and it doesn't talk about the role of Cuba. It doesn't talk about the mass revolutionary struggle to the extent it should and deserves to be talked about. At the same time, it does inspire, I think, the younger generation to want to take up social responsibility. And that's a key thing. If the people will be activated, if the people will join in some aspect of struggle, some join in some form of critical thinking and participate in the dialogue, how to get us out of this bloody jam that we're in, you know, this terrible impasse that these big corporations, these billionaires are putting us in, you know, irrespective of their good words, you know.
One of the things that I think is important to remember is that our struggles will only be as effective as we join forces with other struggles. You know, when we look at the invasion of Libya, when we look at the war-torn area in Syria and what is happening in Syria, I think we can learn about our own ways of becoming engaged, because it is important to recognize how we participate by our silence. You know, I mean, when our governments are allowed to take action, you know, and we tacitly or perhaps naively or unwillingly consent, you know, we participate. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the significance of both, you know, the invasion of Libya, but also what is happening today in Syria.
Yeah, well, I think I'll log on to Syria because it is a 2013 story. Libya, of course, we know clearly now that NATO wanted to eliminate this particular regime that grew up in the bipolar division of the world. They wanted to assert their dominance there, the U.S. in particular, Britain and Canada and so on. And they have unleashed anarchy there, frankly. That's what they have done. They've destroyed the infrastructure and they've unleashed anarchy. If anyone looks deeply into it, you can see that the Libyan people are way behind. Like, whatever problems they had under Gaddafi, and God knows they had problems, but compared to what they have today, it's night and day. Now, if we go to Syria, what we see something quite distinct and quite, we should reflect on it. First of all, how did Syria come into being as a state, Sylvia? It came into being, and bear in mind, this is 2014. This August, we are going to reflect on World War I, a century ago. And already the dialogue has started in the mass media. You listen to the CBC, and number one, they tell you that Britain and France fought a heroic and defensive war against the aggressive and bad Germans under Kaiser Wilhelm. Sorry, it doesn't work. That is not what happened. Kaiser Wilhelm certainly was aggressive because he was rising up to balance off the power between his powerful Germany, which was more modern, more powerful, and frankly more civilized than the regimes in Britain and France, because Britain and France had stolen all the colonies. And so this was a war between imperialist gangsters as to who would own and exploit what territories in Africa, in Asia, indirectly through Latin America and so on. So in that war, in 1916, in a room off the halls of the House of Commons in London, England, two gentlemen, one by the name of Sykes and the other by the name of Picot, one from France, one from England, took the map of the Ottoman Empire and they drew pencil lines and they created countries with their pencil lines. And they said, oh, well, let's make sure, because they knew everything about that region. Their anthropologists had been crawling around there like ants, and they knew everything about everybody. And they said, okay, well, let's make sure, for example, we'll make sure that Kurds, these mountain nation, we'll make sure they don't have a country of their own. We'll make sure they're in everybody's backyard to cause trouble. And that's what they did. So they drew the lines of the map, which is the Middle East today. Well, now those lines don't serve the interests of the United States of America. They don't serve the interests of the European Union. And so they are redrawing lines, and they are remaking the map of the Middle East, and they're remaking it on the basis of communalism, and they want to undermine all the states that had emerged from World War One, that went through some historical development, that developed some identity as states, and, you know, instituted things like the Iraqi state was quite an important secular state that had quite good educational system, had quite good relations with the women. They had more status in Iraq than they had in many of the other states, certainly than in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt, and then Syria the same. So now they want to destroy those states, and they have gone about doing so with 2000. Well, when was the invasion of Iraq? 2003? Mm-hmm. I think that's when it was. They did that. They invaded. They wiped that place out. Still today, they've incited communalism. They incite this terrible, dreadful civil strife there. In Syria, same thing. They have unleashed this whole so-called jihadist movement. At the same time, Islam and the Muslim peoples are trying to modernize their religion, trying to come to grips with the modern world, trying to come to grips with imperialism. So a very complicated but equally dangerous situation, because it's manipulated still very largely by the United States of America, and that is the Syrian crisis today. So without exaggerating, one can say that between Saudi Arabia and the United States, they have unleashed the horror that is in Syria. And what can one say except that, you know, these imperialists should be stopped. And the only comment you could make about, say, the developments in 2013 is they had hoped, the United States being they, and its Western allies, Canada included, had hoped that they would invade Syria, but they got stopped by Russia. And so what did that tell us? That tells us that Russia is still a power. Russia somehow exerted some military muscle in that region, and the United States backed off, and there was a deal to get this gas out of Syria. Now, what does it tell us, Sylvia? It tells us that the inter-imperialist conflict between these major powers, and they include Russia, they include the U.S., they include Japan, they include China, and so on and so forth, these powers, if they are not blocked, if anti-war governments are not brought into power in Canada, U.S., and Europe, and various other places, governments that say no to war as a means of foreign policy, they will go to war. They will go into international conflict. So that's why we raise this slogan in Canada right today. We say we want an anti-war government. We do not want to be dragged into World War One in the, you know, stage right of World War Three. In other words, we don't want a repeat of that suicidal, terrible war of mutual destruction that these big six empires launched against each other in order to redivide the world.
We've come to the end of our interview, Charles. Thank you so much for being with us. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.